It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
It's time for episode 138 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. I'm so glad you're listening. This week I have a great interview with Ruben Romero, one of the creators of a great comic called The Agency from Think Alike Productions. You can check them out at thinkalikeproductions.com, of course, and their Facebook page. The Agency happens to do with an international agency dealing with magic, and a teenager comes to their attention, among other things. We talk about how the book came to be and some things in the future that we might see in the comic. There's a lot to get to, so let's get on with the show. Welcome to the podcast, Ruben Romero, one of the creators of The Agency, a great book that I got to read at Florida SuperCon recently. So how are you doing today, Ruben?
I'm doing good, Wayne. I'm doing good. Thank you for having me.
It's good to talk with you because I really enjoyed the book quite a bit. And I wanted to talk with you a little bit about it. Do you want to tell people how this book came to be? How did you guys come to create it?
Yeah, it's actually written by me, my wife, Bethany, and my best friend since middle school, Roger Cabrera. And basically, we always knew we wanted to do something creatively. We were writing scripts and out of budget, of course, not writing anything that you could shoot independently. And one day we just decided to say, hey, you know what, let's move the medium from screenplays to comic books. And really, we just needed the content. And we were searching through ideas, going through ideas. And Roger suggested mages. And I had never heard of the term. And he explained to me what it was. And immediately, the wheels started to turn. So, you know, basically we just decided that we wanted to work with mages. We wanted to work in the realm of magic. It was just about the details and how we got there and just getting together and writing those things and really just laying down the blueprint to what eventually became The Agency, because it started off as Mages for Hire.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Okay, so were you guys into comics before? I mean, had you been reading comics?
Yeah, definitely. Okay. As a kid, I grew up collecting them and Marvel trading cards and in and out of comic book stores. Miami, unfortunately, didn't have a lot, you know, and still doesn't. But my brothers, I had two older brothers who, you know, once they got paid, they would take me to the comic book store, let me get a pack of cards, let me get a book. And I developed a love from there. And Roger and Bethany's dad is an art critic for the Miami New Times. So she grew up with an art background and she read Archie growing up. And Roger's always been in love with the comic book world since a little kid. So, you know, we've always had that in common.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Now, why don't you tell people what The Agency is about, sort of like a TV guide description?
Okay, basically, what I like to tell people at the convention is that it's Harry Potter meets Mission Impossible, minus the wands. So basically, what's going on is that the world's been overran by dark mage terrorist groups, and instead of sending the FBI or the CIA, the government creates the International Agency of Magic so that they can fight magic with magic. And basically, our window into that world is a young orphan named Riley Dean, who accidentally stumbles onto his magical capabilities, and that puts him on the radar of the agency. And once he's brought in, we start to figure out that just like any other government agency, there's a lot of deceit and secrets and corruption, and it's not by coincidence that Riley is in the walls of the IAM. And basically, you know, all of our agents, they all have a specific magical skill set that they stick to. And they don't travel outside of that skill set. But throughout the course of the story, Riley will be able to control all of those magical skill sets that our agents have, including more, you know, as we expand on the story.
Well, on the cover of the issue, you've got four people that are apparently in the agency. Do you want to outline just who those people are?
Yeah, definitely. All the way to the left is our smart-mouthed British agent, Paul, who is not magically powered himself. He's actually one of the only agents that we'll see that actually has a magical sort of object that he needs to use to create the magic, and that's his staff. Basically, it's been passed down from generation to generation, and eventually we'll get to a point where we go back and we learn about, you know, his family and that staff. Next to him is our suave, debonair 007 Remo, and basically he's a sensor. He can sense what magic is being used, at what level, is it good, is it bad. He has no radius. If he's really in tune with what's going on, he can actually follow the trace that's been left by that magic. And he's our hand-to-hand expert. He's the one that trains all of our agents in hand-to-hand combat, because eventually, even though you are magically powered, eventually you will have to get close to somebody at some point. And then we have Ayo, who is our healer. He is our only mage that is in costume, so to speak, and it's by choice. He has a backstory. There's a reason why he covers his face, and he's not always showing it. And like I said, he is our healer. There is a twist to his healing capability. He can store whatever wound he has healed and project that injury onto an attacker. He can choose, you know, whatever injury he's stored at the moment, broken arm, you know, neck, leg, ribs, whatever the case may be, he can transfer those injuries. And then there is our leader, who is a female. And we got a lot of, you know, a lot of questions about that. But we chose Victoria, a female, to lead this team because we thought that, you know, a lot of strong male characters always have a good woman behind them, or in this case, in front of them. And Victoria Winter is our leader, and she is our conjurer. She can conjure anything from an exit, like a door or a plane. Just depending on the size of the conjure, it may take her some time. But other than that, those are our four main agents that we'll be following along with Riley.
I'm kind of surprised. People are questioning that there's a woman in charge of the group.
Well, you know, comic book readers, you know, nowadays, you know, it's something that us as writers, we took into account because, you know, I love Joss Whedon and J.J. Abrams, and they always have this strong female lead character. And it just seems that the comic book community needs to start accepting that more, that women can do just about anything that a man can do. And, you know, and I think Marvel took the right step in presenting a female Thor. I think that it does great things for the character, and it gives the character an opportunity to do things that maybe he hasn't been able to do before. So we thought, government agency, what better twist than to have a woman leading the group instead of just some strong chiseled chin man, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have enough white males in comics, it seems to me. Yeah. We can stand a couple of women in charge, and I happen to agree with you. It didn't bother me in the slightest that Agent Winter was the one in charge. In fact, I kind of like that because you've got a really diverse group, and that's one of the things I love in comics, is to have something that's not just all, as you say, them chiseled, jawed white males
right.
Running around. It's nice to get, because the healer of the group, he looks sort of Middle Eastern in his makeup. Is he from the Middle East?
He's actually African. He comes from a small Swahili village, and all his incantations are actual Swahili. We don't make up any words or anything like that. We've actually gone into dialect and language and stuff like that for all of our magic, whether it's AO's African background or maybe just, you know, Latin and stuff like that. So we've taken from different dialects so that we can create the magic, but grounded in reality. So we're not making up any incantations. We're actually putting real words together to create something.
That was one of my questions, so I'm glad you said that. I was just curious as to how you got the magic words. And it's kind of interesting to me that you do those kinds of things. And another thing about magic that always drives me crazy is when magic is the woo-woo ray, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You just all of a sudden you need something to stop something, and so all of a sudden your magic can do that.
Right.
Never was able to do that before.
Right.
But now suddenly it's able to do it because you need that in the story.
Right.
And it sounds to me like the way you're describing them, you're not going there. Route, which I really like the sound of that.
No, I think that one of the things that we tried to do was to ground it as real as possible. You know, it's still a comic book, but at the end of the day, like, I don't want you to feel like just because Remo can sense that he's going to see everything coming, or just because Ayo can heal, doesn't mean that he can bring somebody back from the dead. And, you know, and we don't have necessarily concrete rules, but we do want you to feel for our characters. So if there is danger, I want you to feel like they're in danger. I don't want you to feel like Victoria's just going to conjure a door and back her way out of a fight, because at the end of the day, they're real human beings. They may be magically powered, but they are real human beings. So, you know, we do want you to make that connection.
One of the cool things that you were handing out at Florida Supercon, there was a little symbol
right. For
the International Agency of Magic, and I have one of those, and I kind of like it. It's interesting that you've got the globe on there and IAM, which they use those initials. Of course, all government agencies use
right. Initials,
and you've got those kinds of things used, and I like that. It's grounded in reality the way that you're saying, but it also has some interesting things that we haven't seen before, which I like. So I like that in the agency real well. Now, let's talk a little bit about Riley. I'm not done with Riley quite yet. Right. When we first meet him, he's in a school, right. A training school. Is that a magical training school he's in?
No, not at all. It's actually an orphanage, so there's different levels to it. We chose to put him in a classroom at the time because his introduction, we wanted to put him in a place where people have been before, as far as that situation. Teenage kids find themselves in classrooms for most of their days and usually have a teacher in their ear. In this case, it was the matron of the orphanage, but same difference in that sense where it's an adult basically telling you that what you're doing, it doesn't matter. You have responsibilities. And even though you think you don't need to, uphold to those responsibilities just because you don't have a parent or anybody to answer to, I'm the person in charge. And basically, that was our way of introducing Riley as the child of a lonely upbringing and basically having to deal with people telling him what to do his whole life. So that beat right after where he staring out of the window right before he leaves, it was very important in our writing when we went to go do it that we gave the audience, the reader that moment. We realize that, yes, he is a teenager and he can be explosive, but he's not reckless. He thinks before he acts a good amount of the time. And at that moment, I feel like, that was once something that we wanted to show, that he wasn't just leaving because he's a snotty-nosed teenager. He believes that what he was doing is important, and that's why he left. So, yeah, I mean, he's growing up in an orphanage, and he's pretty much a loner when we find him.
Well, one of the pivotal points of the book is when he actually discovers he has magic powers if he didn't know that before.
Right.
He's in the middle of a situation, and don't want to spoil it, but he is in a place where there's a lot of tension involved, and he says, I wish there was something I could do, and at that point something happens, and of course don't want to spoil that either, but we get to discover that he's actually got magical abilities.
Right.
And what's great is he doesn't even realize it. And, of course, there's a great precedent in comics, mutants not getting their powers coming until the teen years and things like that. So there's a good precedent for Riley to discover this at this point in his life as well.
Right.
Did you set on that? I mean, has he always had magical abilities or are they just now come to fruition?
I think that once we get deeper into the story, I think we're going to find out that Riley's always been capable of special things. Mm-hmm. He was too busy looking for somebody to guide him in his earlier years to notice his abilities. And I think that that's something that we'll be able to see once the story goes on. As a child, he did do certain things that would make the normal person kind of step back and be like, what's going on here? But I think that growing up in the orphanage and having Matron Austin there since he was a child, I think that she was looking out for his best interest. So I think that, he's just now becoming aware of them, but I think they've always been there,
Okay. Well, that's good. It's good to have something a little different from all the mutants and stuff like that, which we've had. Okay, now we talked about the good guys. Let's talk a little bit about the bad guys.
Right.
In the very beginning, Remo was there, and he's after somebody who's got magical abilities. Of course, the whole group ends up being involved with it. And, do you want to talk about who that person is and what is actually going on? Because he's part of a group as well. Not only is there the agency, but you also have what seems to be their opposite number going.
Well, I love that that's the setup that people are getting, and I'm loving it because it's going to be real interesting by the time we finish out with the Horus. They're our first set of bad guys. Mm-hmm. They have an obsession. Ra, in specific, has an obsession with Egyptian deities and gods. So he's basically got his cronies and himself dressing up like them. And a lot of people are asking me, what are they under the masks? And they're very much real people. They're just dark mages. And eventually, things are going to happen where the Horus, move to the side and other people will come up. And what I love is that people are falling in love with the villains because they're like, man, they're so cool looking. They're so awesome. And I'm just thinking, wait till you see what we've got next, because, this isn't going to be just a one villain story. Obviously, there's a government agency put in place to stop multiple villains. So the Horus are just what we're leading in with. We wanted to make sure that they were great. So that's why we went with cool gods and kind of that Egyptian background, because there's a lot to draw on from there. And it gives you an ability to kind of play with those things.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's two other guys that kind of fascinated me in the book. There's Embry, mm-hmm. I believe his name is. Do you want to tell about who he is?
Embry Eskul. He is the chief of the IAM, the head honcho, so to speak. And in the first issue, if you haven't read it, he's dealing with something internal that has him kind of by the balls, so to speak. We'll get into that, but we see that early on. He's not let into the full picture mm-hmm. by the other character who I think you're talking about, which is Damien, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right, Damien. Damien is our free agent. He's somebody that is going to grow with the story, obviously, just like everybody else. But really, the readers are going to get to know him a little bit more intimately than all the other characters. You know, they'll learn more about Damien a whole lot faster than they will about our other agents, just because he's kind of like the glue. And you'll see why, because he's on both sides. He sees everything that the good guys are doing, and he's on the, you know, he's on the side of the bad guys, making sure that things are happening as well. He's got a certain link to our main villain, which is Teevil.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because that's, as we get to the end of the book, I really hate to give away endings, right, but there's a great little last panel that must be including that person that you're talking about,
right,
because it's all kind of interesting things going on. It's good that we're seeing both the dark and the lighter magics involved, and that they're sort of intertwined on some levels.
Right.
I kind of find that interesting. It reminds me a little bit of the Dresden Files, where it wasn't necessarily black or white.
Right.
There were a lot of shades of gray going on,
right,
and that's what I see in the agency quite a lot.
Right. Well, you know, I don't know so much about the Dresden Files. I have heard a lot about it as of late, because, as you know, people are always comparing things to other things, and that's why I always set it up with Harry Potter meets Mission Impossible, so that people can make certain connections. But I grew up watching Star Wars and stuff like that. It fascinated me how Vader was never fully bad. You know, there was a piece of light in him. The Crow is another character that I grew up watching, you know, who was, you know, for all intents and purposes, a very dark character, but had a lot of light inside of him. And all those characters kind of swam in moral gray areas. So to me, this is a real world, and we're going to set it in reality. There are times where we as normal people, we do things that maybe some other people wouldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it was important for all of our characters in our book, whether it be good or bad, that there is this moral gray area that they do have to swim in so that things can get done.
Mm-hmm. Which is really cool. I like that about it. Another thing I really enjoyed about the book, and I wanted to bring it up, was the fact that they don't necessarily use technology as much as they use magical or mystical implements. There's a time when Agent Winter is talking to the chief,
mm-hmm,
and what they're using is a scroll that rolls down, and actually you see the chief's face on the scroll.
Right.
Which I liked. I thought that was one of the coolest things, because in an era where computers and cell phones and all these things are the norm, we actually get to see the scroll.
Right.
Being used as a way to communicate. I really like that as well. Did you guys come up with that? Are you going to stay away from technology and use more of these kind of magical implements?
Yeah, you know, I think that even though it's a government agency, they're magic. So I feel like if they were talking via Skype or FaceTime or a smartphone, then I'd get the opposite. Like, oh, well, they're magical. Why don't they just have like a mirror or something? So we knew that we wanted to keep it as magical as possible and use little things, you know, like the scroll to replace a computer, because it's very easy to go that route. So as the story develops, we'll see more magical influenced, not technology, but actual objects that they use that are magically powered that they use. You know, Remo has something called sensor stones that are actually lined outside of the gate of the agency. And those are basically just stones that react to a certain kind of magic or to any kind of magic and basically send a signal to the sensor that's tied into those stones. So, you know, we'll see that later on. So, yeah, we don't want to use technology as much as possible. Definitely not.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And another thing I really enjoyed, too, was when a place where Agent Winters talks to the police.
Right.
When they see the badge of the IAM, their response is, I hate to say this, but this is kind of what a lot of government agencies run into when they talk with police and people, local authorities. And he responds, what a joke.
Right.
He goes to her, and, you know, the interesting thing, though, they still get their way,
right,
but they don't necessarily garner a lot of support or respect from the local authorities.
No, and I think we'll see as the story develops, too, why. There is a certain disdain for magically powered people, not in the sense where, so much like the mutants and X-Men, where they're hated and they want to be cured or put on an island, or so to speak, but the regulars is what we call them, an unmagical person. The regulars are kind of going to be the other window into our world and why magic is kind of disrupting. So, you know, and as far as the police and other government agencies, we'll see kind of headbutting. And I think that that just lends itself to the real world. The FBI clashed with the CIA. The NSA keeps secrets from everybody. So basically, we just wanted to make sure that we kept that kind of camaraderie alive in our story, because not everybody holds hands and sings Kumbaya.
Well, I get a kick because this couldn't be timed better as far as like government agencies not being trusted and not being in the limelight, or at least being amongst people who are, if you talk to people about like the IRS or the NSA and all these other stuff, we are not looking at them all that favorably these days.
Right.
And so out of this comes the agency. Were you aware of that kind of stuff possibly being in there when the whole concept came together, or did you kind of just put this in there as something a little different.
I wouldn't say I'm up to date on news, current events, and stuff like that, but just being a person who reads a lot, that watch a lot of TV, and we like to be, you know, as connected as possible to that medium, you know, the entertainment medium as possible. We saw things like Argo, things like Homeland, where our government comes through, but at the same time, they don't, you know? So we knew we wanted to inject that into it, but it wasn't based off of, like, any theories or information or anything that we feel, you know, the government is doing or isn't doing. Mm-hmm.
So if the NSA gets a look at this, they won't be particularly threatened by anything.
I hope not. But, there's no such thing as bad press, so...
Right. Well, yeah. Now, as we get to the last page of the back cover of the book, it's a thing about looks like the next issue coming in. You've got Ryan in this triangle.
Right.
That's Ra that's holding the triangle?
Right, yeah. He's got Riley trapped in there. And that was basically our metaphor for Riley's growth and how he's trying to push out of his boundaries, so to speak. And it's kind of also a little bit of a foreshadow into issue 3 as well, because we kind of turn a corner in issue 3 where we start to find out, you know, maybe Riley is important. Maybe there is more to this kid than just a smart mouth and a cool red hoodie. But he's important. And I think that, you know, we tried to convey that in issue 2.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of issue 2, issue 1 now is available. Now, is this possible to pick this up in stores, the agency, or what's the situation with that?
In South Florida, we'll be at Tate's, and we will definitely be at Max Comics. Both of them can be Googled and found extremely easy. And as far as Comixology, we should have issue 1 back up on there in the next couple of days, I'm thinking. Mm-hmm. If not, they can always check on our Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. But I'm thinking the next couple of days, they just had to switch out the cover. We had to remove a logo and replace it with our logo. They've got all the files cut and ready to go. We did release on June 4th, so they've got everything ready to go. They just needed a new cover, so that's what we're providing them. They also have issue 2, which is slated for August 13th. That might change with the re-release of issue 1, but again, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, we're definitely engaged with that. So worst case scenario, South Florida, we do have printed issues of the agency, and we can drive it out to you. We can mail it to you. We'll do whatever it takes.
If somebody wants to get a hold of you, you talked about Facebook. You guys have a website. Is that your group name is called Think Alike Productions?
Think Alike Productions, yes. That is me, my wife, and my best friend, Roger. Right. Yeah, Think Alike.
Okay, and there's a website. Is it thinkalikeproductions.com?
Right, correct. thinkalikeproductions.com. And that's basically just a landing site for people to be able to get a hold of the Facebook, the Twitter. We're actually working on that right now. We're going to re-release that website along with the agencycomicbook.com, where you'll be able to go and kind of play around on a computer that's inside the headquarters of the IAM. You'll be able to look through agent files, look through redacted information, find out, you know, behind the scenes information, stuff like that. We're constantly going to be updating that. And then the Think Alike Productions website will be geared towards our other projects and stuff that we'll be working on in the future. And you'll have information there on what conventions we'll be attending, so on and so forth. Yeah.
No, I would be remiss if I didn't talk about how great I think the art is.
Oh.
The art in this comic is quite nice, and I have to say, sometimes when you see comics from brand new folks and companies that aren't Marvel and DC, sometimes the art isn't all that great, but this art is really compelling and really engaging, and I wanted to talk a little bit about that. It looks like the person's name, is it Eric Coda?
Eric the Blessing Coda is what I like to call him.
Okay, because the art is really good, and it's really, it looks like a Marvel DC style book. And so for me, that was one of the things I was drawn to right away, was getting into the story, because honestly, you know, there are some books that are out there that are black and white and kind of junkily drawn and stuff like that. You know, everybody's got to start somewhere.
Right.
But this book has a real professional look to it. Not only is the story professional, I think, but the artwork is very professional, too. How did Eric get involved in the process?
Well, let me thank you on his behalf, because I'm sure he'd love to hear it. And that's something that we've been getting a lot. You know, we've been lucky enough, blessed enough, I should say, that people have been, you know, noticing the art and saying, hey, you know what, this really is a cut above. He became involved. Like I said, this has been 3 years in the making, almost four. We started off as Mages for Hire. We've gone through three artists. Mm-hmm. We were turned down by Image 3 times with two separate artists. Eric actually got turned down the third time with the final pass from Image. But you know what? We knew that we had something special with Eric. And, you know, it's funny that you mentioned Marvel, because he's done a little bit of work. I wouldn't say a resident artist, but he was there. He did some pages on a couple of volumes of, like, X-Men or something like that. You would have to check the Marvel website. He does have credits with Marvel. But, you know, that's what makes him a great artist. I think that he's just dedicated to what he does, and he treats it like a job. that's definitely saying something about the independent art community, because I think that, you know, like you said, a lot of art creators, you know, they are a lot of people who create their comic books, you know, they either treat it as a hobby or they treat it so, you know, like the last Coca-Cola in the desert, that it never comes together and that it never really, you know, reaches its full potential, because they're always changing little things. So we knew we set a certain bar for art, and we said we don't want it to look any less than this and any better than that. It needs to be this. And we have a certain test page that we test all the artists that have worked on the agency came through this test page. And it's actually the page where Damien crashes into Embry's office and he's forming. Once he sent that page, and it's the same page that you're looking at in the book, we knew that we had something with him. So he came through us through DeviantArt, and we've been working with him ever since.
Very cool. And I also have to say the coloring is quite good, too. Oh. The very first panel is sort of a Sphinx-like image. And the way that the light and the coloring is on that, right away, I felt very professional. So the art and the color really came together on that. Is Ross Hughes is the guy providing the color?
Ross Hughes is our colorer. He actually works full-time for Hi-Fi Studios, and they're the guys that do the coloring for DC.
Oh.
And again, we set a bar for ourselves, Wayne. We just said we knew we didn't want to come out with something subpar. Our dream was to put it on a shelf and go to the conventions, and we knew we were going to have to talk to people face-to-face, so we knew we wanted a certain look for it. And when Ross came through us, again, through DeviantArt, you know, which is a blessing for independent creators, there is a gold mine there. You just have to remain patient. And through the people who aren't serious. But again, we went through four artists. We probably went through 40 colorists, 50 colorists, you know.
Wow.
It just wasn't what we were looking for. They didn't pop. It didn't look right. And, you know, I found Ross in DeviantArt, and my wife reached out to him. And at the beginning, he was like, look, you know, I can't do it. I'm busy, this and that. And we were like, okay, well, can you recommend? And he recommended. And, you know, we tested all of the people he recommended. They still didn't look like anything that we wanted. So we went back to him and pleaded with him and begged him. And finally, he gave in. And I think he thought it was going to be for a one-time thing. And now he's just like, let's keep going. Let's keep getting the agency out there. So, you know, we're lucky to have him on board. And like you said, it's professional. It feels professional. It's because he is. He works on Aquaman. He works on Green Lantern. He works on Batman. So, I mean, the same colors that you're seeing in those books, you're going to get in our books, because that's what he's doing.
Pop is a good word for it. It really just kind of leaps off the page, which is really great. So it's good. Now, you mentioned something that piqued my interest, too. You talked about an issue 3. Mm-hmm. Now, chapter 1 is called Emergence. How many issues is included in chapter 1? Is it the first issue, or is that like in several issues?
There'll be single issue chapters. So the fifth chapter will create a volume. So each book will be named.
Okay.
The chapters will have individual names.
So the second issue will be chapter 2, and the third issue will be chapter 3.
Right.
Okay. So we're aiming for August. Any idea when issue 3 is going to come out? Is it going to be sometime around the holidays or sometime this fall?
I would say probably October. October. We're going to try to keep it bi-monthly. This issue with our previous publisher kind of threw a kink in our system. But like I said, we're a couple of days back from being back on Comixology. Eric's got the script to issue 3. He's working right now. He's actually working on an exclusive 11x17 poster that we're going to have up at Tampa Bay Comic Con in the next couple of weeks. So he's working on the book. He's working on that. So we're definitely moving full steam ahead.
Oh, great. I'll probably see you there, because I'm planning to go to Tampa Bay as well.
That's awesome.
So that would be good to do. I have to say that your booth really did draw my attention. I was glad that you had a booth there. It got at least my attention, and I'm sure other people as well. Is there any chance of this getting into, like, Diamonds?
You know, we're going to New York Comic Con this year in October, and like I said, we have a very serious mind state. Think of Light Productions is kind of evolving as we speak. We'll probably be changing our name as well to Think of Light Studios, or maybe just another entity. But we definitely want to provide other stories and go different routes, and New York Comic Con is going to give us the opportunity to talk to Diamond face to face. So like I said, we're definitely moving forward. We have plans for the future, so I would love to be able to have this on shelves nationwide.
I don't see why not, because it definitely looks, I've seen other books in stores that weren't nearly as good as this, so I really hope that you guys get to be able to show your wares off across the country.
Well, let me tell you, if the local comic shops, if we don't get into Diamond, if we don't set anything up in October, next year is going to be a busy year for us. We're, you know, we've got cons planned throughout the year, one or two a month throughout all next year on the East Coast, Midwest, and West Coast. So we're going to be traveling everywhere. If nobody wants to help, then we're going to go do it ourselves, you know?
Okay. Well, you know, it's definitely worth the effort that you're putting into it. And I, like I said, I really enjoyed it. And I'm looking forward to issue number 2. I can't wait for it to hit Comixology. And so anxious for further issues to come. So I think you're doing good stuff. And I highly encourage you guys to keep going, because this is a great book and it's a lot of fun to read. And there's a lot of possibilities I can see in stories that are coming. You're just barely scratching the surface with issue 1.
Definitely. And that's another thing. Establishing a world and world building in an issue 1 is very sensitive. So there's, mm-hmm. you know, there's things that you want to let people know, and then there's things that you want to set up for the future. But there are seeds being planted, and I think that we've got a great, great story planned for our readers. And, you know, all we can ask is be faithful, be patient, and be loyal, and we will definitely, definitely deliver with the agency.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to it. Jim Rubin, much success, and sounds like we got other irons that might come into the fire, too. So get a hold of the agency. It's Think Alike Productions. And Comixology, hopefully by the time this airs, it'll be back on Comixology, and things are going. And Ruben, you'll be a big success, and you have more than just the agency out there to read.
That's what we're hoping, Wayne. That's what we're hoping.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored. I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
Now at MajorSpoilers.com. And that's a wrap for this episode. Be back next week when I'll have an interview with Alex Lobato, one of the creators of Max Hunter Snowfall Part 1 from Darkseid Global. It's a great comic that was funded through Kickstarter and has a big future, I think. So I'm sure you're going to want to hear what he has to say. But until then, keep reading your comics.